Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Nancy M. Heinzen. Her History of Rittenhouse Square, The Perfect Square, is published by Temple University Press. Susan Lewis takes us to the Penn Museum's exhibition about generations of Pennsylvanians who kept their Lenape identity secret for two centuries. Jason Pfeiffer delves into the history of tattoos and body art with a visit to an exhibition at the Independent Seaport Museum in Philadelphia. Skin and Bones explores the beliefs, mysteries, and traditions of the tattoo in American maritime culture. And as part of a series exploring overlooked events in local history, Tom Keels reports on the Miskianza, a citywide party held in Philadelphia during the War of Independence in honor of a British Army general. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Tucked amid the bustle of downtown Philadelphia lies Rittenhouse Square, a bucolic retreat for city dwellers and visitors alike. This public space, spotted with trees, a reflecting pond and sculptures, has also become a status symbol for those who live there. The park, one of the five open squares around which Philadelphia was organized, is the subject of a new book, The Perfect Square, by Nancy M. Heinzen. The book chronicles the many faces of the park throughout the area's history, featuring many archival photos and illustrations. Outside of her writing, Heinzen, a longtime resident of Rittenhouse Square, is involved with organizations dedicated to its upkeep and preservation. We think today of Rittenhouse Square as this highly elite residential area. It wasn't always thus.
Certainly not. It had very humble origins. Philadelphia is built of brick buildings, and Philadelphia lies on a bed of very high-grade clay, which is perfect for brickmaking. And of course, making bricks is a very labor-intensive, dirty job. And where better to put it than to the western part of the city? So they had brickyards and brick kilns. And as the city moved west, the brickyards would move out that way.
And these brickyards, in their turn, then attracted some wildlife.
Yes, the clay pits would collect rain and attracted geese, and the area became known as Goose Town, which is not such an elegant name for when you think what Rittenhouse Square finally became, but it was called Goose Town.
But it wasn't named Goose Town for very long, and it became this very prestigious place to live in, what, the early 20th century?
Actually, it became the place to live in the 19th century. It was the Civil War that made Philadelphia. And there were three things that made Philadelphia a powerhouse. One was the coal that was coming in from the northern part of the state. The other was large deposits of iron that surround the whole Pennsylvania area counties. And the third thing was the railroads, the mighty Pennsylvania. It was the largest corporation three times over in the world. And it was the great powerhouse. After the Civil War, the South was in a shambles. New England had some manufacturing, but Philadelphia, people don't realize this, but Philadelphia was the center of manufacturing and making things. And, of course, this gave rise to wealth. It created tremendous wealth. And the people who became wealthy had to have a nice address, a place to live. And this is, when people think of Rittenhouse Square and they think of wealthy, rich, elite, it stems back to that era.
But just as the railroads and the great fortunes that they earned for the residents of this area were one of the reasons why it became so prestigious, so too were these railway barons part of the reason that the square became less popular.
Well, what happened was the railroads were the downfall of Rittenhouse Square, because all of these people in their brownstone mansions around the square, heads of the railroads decided that they needed to expand, and what they encouraged their board people and their people who ran the railroad to do was to buy property outside the city and build summer homes. And these people built summer cottages, some of them call them, summer homes, out along what became known as the main line of the Pennsylvania Railroad. And they bought up large pieces of land, and they built very nice houses, and they decided that it wasn't bad living out there year-round. And eventually what happened was that the shakers and movers of the post-Civil War era became the new rich out on the main line, and the square more or less started to decline. Now, I'm talking about the 1900s, early 1900s.
But not everybody headed off to the mainland. There were still people who wanted to be here.
There were still people around who cared about the square and how it looked and what was going to become of it. And a group of them got together and hired an architect by the name of Paul Cray, who was one of the great architects of the Beaux-Arts period. He came from France, and they hired him to landscape the square. And he landscaped it based on a French park. This was an English square that got morphed into a French park. A lot of people compare it to Parc Monceau, but it's not Parc Monceau in Paris. It's more like the Luxembourg Gardens because you have your allée of chestnut trees. And even in homage to the lagoon in Luxembourg Gardens where little boys sailed their boats, he built a reflecting pool with a very whimsical, beautiful, whimsical mural. And it's Neptune's Garden. It's all seaweed and little animals and things, sea creatures. So this lovely French type of garden now is in Rittenhouse Square.
Nancy M. Heinzen. Her book about Rittenhouse Square, The Perfect Square, is out now on Temple University Press.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
According to conventional history, few, if any, Lenape Indians remained in Pennsylvania after the 18th century, most having been killed or driven west by European settlers. However, an exhibition at the University of Pennsylvania Museum tells the story of those who stayed, forming communities whose members hid their Lenape identities, yet managed to continue and pass on their traditions in secret for nearly two centuries. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to Fulfilling a Prophecy, the Past and the Present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania.
When University of Pennsylvania anthropology student Abigail Selden was putting together a one-case exhibit about what happened to the Lenape people, she met with the elders of today's Lenape Nation of Pennsylvania and asked them why there was virtually nothing about them in the literature.
Every book I've read says that you don't exist and that you're not in Pennsylvania anymore. And they said, yeah, we know. I said, but you're here. And they said, well, we've been keeping our history a secret for 200 years, so of course it's not in the books.
The Lenape's cautious willingness to share their history was a doorway, opened a crack, into another culture, a natural fit with a museum dedicated to understanding the world's cultural heritage, let alone one in its own backyard. Selden's advisor, anthropology professor Bob Prussell, curator of North America at the Penn Museum, says that while most of the cultures in the museum are presented at a point in the past.
For example, ancient Egypt, we have incredible collections here, but there's not a lot on contemporary Egypt here. So one of the things that we want to do with Native America is to show the continuities and connections between the archaeology, the history, and the contemporary communities.
So what started out as a small student project grew into a museum show covering hundreds of years. Co-curated by Selden, along with Chief Bob Red Hawk Ruth and Shelley DePaul of the Lenape Nation, it took its shape and context from a story handed down through the generations called Prophecy of the Fourth Crow, about, among other things, hiding and returning.
Long ago it was said that a fox will be loosened on the earth. Also, it was said four crows will come.
As the story goes, the first crow flew in harmony with the Creator. The second crow tried to clean the world, but he became sick and died. The third crow saw his dead brother, and he hid. The fourth crow flew the way of harmony again with the Creator. The ending comes full circle.
Caretakers, they will live together on the earth.
As told here, the first crow in the prophecy corresponds to the Lenape before the first contact with Europeans. The second crow represents the period from about 1600 until 1800, when initially peaceful coexistence with William Penn and others deteriorated in subsequent generations. This is starkly illustrated by an enlarged 1764 ad placed by one of William Penn's sons in Benjamin Franklin's Pennsylvania Gazette.
John Penn is offering payment to civilians who capture Delaware or Lenape individuals or who kill them and turn in their scalps as evidence. And the payment for a male over 10 years of age was $134 and for a female $50. So there was a really clear heritage in Pennsylvania of indiscriminate violence against people of Native American heritage.
By the beginning of the 19th century, Remaining Lenape had either fled or gone into hiding. And it is the next 200 years of secrecy, represented by the Third Crow, that is the driving force of this exhibition. Chief Bob Redhawk says his people found ways to survive.
Whether it was intermarriage, whether it was hiding who you are, you did whatever you could. If you could pass as a white or even as African-American, and this is even during segregation times, we were low men on the totem pole.
Passing as members of other ethnic groups was in some cases made easier because intermarriage was common. Selden says Lenape women, for example, married German farmers and kept connections to their land. Generations of intermarriage eventually created a population with looks as diverse as the larger culture. Children could be blonde and fair-skinned, dark with black hair, and everything in between. Outwardly, they assumed a non-Lenape identity. In the privacy of family gatherings, they continued to practice Lenape traditions and pass down stories. Even outward appearances were full of symbols, as shown in this exhibition on things as ordinary as a kitchen apron with a particular stitch along the bottom, or a wooden fence post with a subtle carving.
Poles like this one were scattered throughout farmland. This has a face on it pretty clearly, but it could just be a signpost.
And what is the face?
It represents Mising, who's the protector of the woodlands.
The importance of secrecy was drummed into the youngest of children, as evidenced by a rag doll in this show.
If you look carefully underneath her hair, which is now pulled to both sides, you can see that there's a second face. And this was a doll that was made for a little girl by her Lenape grandmother in the 1940s. And the woman told the little girl that this doll had the second face and that this represented the little girl's Lenape face and her identity, which she had to keep a secret because she could not tell anybody who she was.
Secrecy, rooted in fear, became part of the culture. But now, perhaps it is indeed the time of the Fourth Crow. In recent years, more people have begun to openly acknowledge their Lenape heritage, particularly as caretakers of nature. In 2002, the Lenape Nation signed the first Treaty of Brotherhood with churches and other community groups, pledging to support the Lenape cultural education programs and their work for the environment. The chief himself has traveled openly internationally, on tour with his large drum, which for now sits in a gallery at the Penn Museum, along with artifacts and photographs, evidence of children and parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents.
These people were living, breathing people, and it's because of their ways of surviving that we're here today, and we're hoping that our children can come in here now and be proud.
It is their story, and it is our story. A rich texture in the national fabric, an important part of what it means to be an American, native or not.
That report was by WRTI's Susan Lewis. Fulfilling a prophecy, the past and present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania is at the University of Pennsylvania Museum through July 11th. Tattoos are pretty common today. They adorn athletes, bikers, movie stars, soccer moms, even Barbie dolls. But in the United States, this body art hasn't always been so ubiquitous. The Independent Seaport Museum in Philadelphia currently has an exhibition that explores the tradition and development of tattooing in America. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer now reports, the show provides a rare and detailed look at the role of tattoos in maritime culture.
Tattooing is not new. Using needles and ink to create permanent marks on the human skin has been practiced in cultures around the world for thousands of years. In some cultures, tattoos have long had religious significance, while others treat it more as decoration. There are more sinister chapters in history with tattooing, when permanent marks were used to identify persecuted groups, prisoners, and slaves. Tattoos have also had a special relationship with the sea, or at least those living on it. Craig Bruns conceived and researched the Independent Seaport Museum's new show, Skin and Bones, Tattoos in the Life of the American Sailor. Inspired by tattoo design samples, called Flash, that have long been part of the museum's collection, Bruns created the exhibit to examine the origins of tattooing in the United States. While tattoos have been around for many centuries, Bruns says American traditions of the body art began with British seafarers in the 1700s.
during the Revolutionary War and the colonial period, of course, there wasn't really an America. So British sailors had a long tradition. And for much of the early American Republic, sailors were the only individuals with tattoos.
The men picked up tattooing traditions as they visited the South Pacific Islands, Mediterranean cultures, and other parts of the world. In some ways, the indelible markings were souvenirs, but Craig Bruns says they were much more than that. Tattoos represented the unique sailor life on the sea.
They had a whole separate culture, and tattoos were the things that signified them visually from others. Tattoos were like guild symbols. Various craft guilds had their aprons or their symbols, while sailors had their tattoos.
Seafarers continue to carry on these traditions of tattooing. Skin and Bones includes Popeye the Sailor Man's tattoos and a Norman Rockwell image of a sailor getting inked. And actual sailors talk on film about the personal significance of their markings.
Basically, all the tattoos I have represent some part of me, whether my personality or anything I've been through or anything that I'm trying to become.
To be sure, not all sailors have tattoos these days, but the body art continues to hold deep meaning for many. Philadelphia native Richard Sam Benedetto has been in the Coast Guard for 18 years. His body is covered with dozens of tattoos. He's not exactly sure how many. He stopped counting at 54. According to Sam Benedetto, tattoos have long signified a rite of passage among sailors, helping to create strong relational bonds.
Only so many people can experience what 50-foot seas are like getting to it in the equator when you go through the Panama Canal, when you sail around the Horn. There's certain crossings. Each sailor goes through a rite of passage, and to now be associated with it, you know, sometimes they might tattoo an anchor. You sail in the Atlantic, swallows for 5,000 miles at sea. They will tattoo that on them, and that's where the brotherhood comes in.
In a large photograph at the Seaport Museum, visitors can get a look at Sam Benedetto's feet. A pig is tattooed on the left foot and a rooster on the right. Sam Benedetto says the animals demonstrate how superstition also plays a part in sailor tattoo traditions.
Two things I've heard at sea, these animals don't swim and they want to get you back safe. So you tattoo rooster on the right, pig on the left, and they'll get you there. The other one is that they kept these animals in crates, and when the ships sank, these crates floated free, and they were the survivors of a shipwreck. So superstitious, hey, they're on my feet. I'm still here today, and I've been through a lot.
Life on the sea is hard. Craig Bruns says historically, sailors didn't have many possessions or personal space, no place to hang a picture or decorate.
But you did have your body, and so you could carry those images with you. Images of good luck, images to identify yourself, images to remember loved ones.
Inspired by their experiences at sea, sailors started, in large part, the tattooing trade in America.
When you have the needle on there, it actually, this is what it sounds like when you're tattooing.
Edward Denny, also known as Sailor Eddie, is a Philadelphia-based tattooist. Sitting in his tattoo parlor at 2nd Street and Girard Avenue, he explains that his grandmother and grandfather started tattooing in 1933, and he began giving tattoos in their shop when he was 8 years old.
What I remember as a kid, up until when the Navy Yard closed, I remember sailors, it was a big part of our business.
And the early tattooists in the United States were usually sailors, setting up shop in port towns like Philadelphia, San Francisco, Norfolk, and Seattle. Ex-sailors and traveling carnivals helped bring tattooing traditions to Middle America, yet Sailor Eddie says the imprint of sailor culture remained.
It defined a style, and it was mandated because of the liberties and people being on leave, and they'd come into port, and you had to do a tattoo really fast because they got paid on the 1st and the 15th. You wanted to get them before their money ran out. So you had to get them on, do good work, and do it as fast as you could to get to the next guy. And that is what defined what is known as the traditional style of tattooing.
Okay. How would you describe that traditional style in terms of the aesthetics of it?
It's a bold outline with a lot of black shading and only three or four solid colors.
The basic elements of tattooing haven't changed much since Samuel O'Reilly invented the electric tattoo machine in 1891. But tattoos have become more detailed, nuanced in shading, and even abstract as new generations take on the craft. Nick Schoenberger, a Philadelphia-based tattoo scholar, says the popularity of body art has ebbed and flowed in the United States for hundreds of years, pointing to the subcultures of hip-hop, bikers, punks, gangs, and sailors. He believes the practice is rooted in the desire to be associated with other people or an idea.
Primarily, I think it's always about group identity and the individual within that group.
But Schoenberger admits that as tattoos become more socially acceptable in mainstream culture, increasingly etched on more visible body parts, body art is becoming less about group identity.
Now is the first time since maybe the early 1900s, 19-teens, where tattooing is also fashionable.
A fashion that in American culture can be credited to sailors. From colonial times until today, their tattooing customs remain unbroken, sustained by camaraderie, superstition, and memory. This ancient art form continues to grow and evolve as it reflects and projects identity on the sea, in the playing field, or at the mall.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Skin and Bones, Tattoos and the Life of the American Sailor is at the Independent Seaport Museum in Philadelphia through February 7th. One of the myths of the American Revolution is that every Philadelphian was a loyal patriot. In reality, many supported King George III, especially when the British Army occupied Philadelphia from 1777 to 78. Now WRTI's Tom Keels looks back at how local Tories collaborated with British soldiers to throw the biggest, gaudiest party this city has ever seen, the notorious Miskianza.
In May 1778, the British Army had occupied Philadelphia for nearly 9 months, but their hold on the capital of the rebellious colonies was loosening. After a rough winter at Valley Forge, George Washington's Continental Army was ready to fight again. In Paris, King Louis XVI had pledged French support for the American cause. Kerry Dethorn, chief curator at Independence National Historical Park, sees 1778 as the beginning of the end for Great Britain.
Within a few months, the worm had sort of turned, and the fortunes of the British Army fell when Washington was able to remobilize. And they said, look, we got to get out of Philadelphia. We got to go up to New York City, where we have a stronghold, and it's much safer for us.
When General William Howe, head of the British Army in America, was relieved of his command, British officers used his departure as an excuse for a going-away gala. John Andre, Howe's aide-de-camp, devised a magnificent, if oddly named, celebration, says Laura Keim, curator at Stenton and Wick in Germantown.
Andre picked the name Miskianza. It comes from two Italian words that mean to mix and to mingle. And perhaps that's part of the motivation, mixing with the natives and mingling with the natives while you can.
The priorities of the British look a bit skewed today. It's as if the U.S. Army marked the collapse of South Vietnam in 1975, not with a mad dash to helicopters atop the American embassy, but with a blowout bash at the Saigon Hilton. But Kerry Dethorn sees a method in the Britons' seeming madness.
So they decided, oh, we're not going out in the cover of darkness. We're not going out, you know, with a whimper. We're going out with a bang. And so they put this party together, and its theme was almost like a medieval pageant or tournament. And their attempt to kind of put a smiley face on the fact that the British Army was being kicked out of Philadelphia.
On May 18, 1778, the Miskianza commenced with a flotilla that carried British officers down the Delaware River. Accompanying them were hundreds of guests from the city's most distinguished families. Philip Seitz, curator of history at Clifton, sees their presence as a symbol of Revolutionary America's political rupture.
There are a lot of people who are undecided, and there are a lot of people who are still loyal to the king, who feel that revolution, in fact, is too far for America to go. And in fact, some of the leading families of Philadelphia go over to the British side and serve in some offices under the British to help administer Philadelphia while the troops are in the city.
Seitz believes that the Miskianza also symbolized British efforts to win the hearts and minds of upper-class Philadelphians, many of whom feared having their political and economic dominance destroyed by the rebellion.
There is a commonality between the rich Americans and the officers who are celebrating. They all come from the same class and are celebrating in common. What they're doing is they're thumbing their noses at the people who are sort of at the bottom.
The regatta landed at Walnut Grove, a country estate at what is now Wharton Street in South Philadelphia. There, 14 British officers led by John Andre fought a mock joust. Carrie Dethorn feels that it must have made for an odd spectacle.
They even had knights and their ladies, and it couldn't have been more absurd, given that it's not the Middle Ages, it's the late 18th century, and they're not lords and ladies, they're British officers and people of Philadelphia, citizens of Philadelphia from the upper echelons. But they were pretending to be the ultimate, I think, symbols of privilege.
The British knights were fighting for the favors of 14 aristocratic American girls like Peggy Shippen and Peggy Chu. These Miskianza maidens constituted Philadelphia's social A-list. They were the 18th century equivalents of Edie Sedgwick or even Paris Hilton. All were attired in Oriental style gowns and turbans designed by the ever-present John Andre. Laura Kime believes that these exotic costumes helped to transform the young ladies of Philadelphia into a harem for British officers.
The women wearing Turkish dress to me is just highly symbolic of the British view of America as a colonial place, and women in particular as a kind of colonial commodity.
After the tournament ended in a tie, the guests retired to a nearby mansion for dancing and a supper consisting of over 1,000 different dishes. The banquet hall was illuminated by hundreds of candelabra, reflected in dozens of mirrors. Laura Kime sees this as blatant profligacy in the midst of widespread deprivation.
And so just imagining this incredible extravagance at a time when, wartime, when trade had been seized and some people are probably not eating, people are suffering, houses are being burned down, and yet the fact that Andre and his posse can set up hundreds of looking glasses, which are just incredible luxuries to begin with in the 18th century, and hundreds of candles that are all being reflected by all this glass. It's like going to, I don't know, a fun house or a Disneyland or something for us. It's just out of this world, really.
The Miskianza's 14 hours of revelry were followed by a long hangover. Less than a month later, the British evacuated Philadelphia for New York, accompanied by 3,000 loyalists fearful of retribution. But most of the Miskianza maidens and their families elected to remain in Philadelphia and face the music. According to Carrie Dethorn, this music turned out to be surprisingly sweet.
And you wonder, well, after the Miskianza, those women must have been just pariahs. I mean, people must have said, well, you participated in that, you know, effete event, and we never want to speak to you again, which is not the case at all. The women who were part of that event were, after the Miskianza, went right back to their social status that they had before the event.
Most of the Miskianza maidens married prominent men and became pillars of the new American aristocracy, which emerged after the Revolution. Peggy Chu, one of John Andre's conquests, wed war hero John Eager Howard, later governor of Maryland. Peggy made the mistake of telling a friend, in front of her husband, that Andre was a most witty and cultivated gentleman. Governor Howard promptly bellowed,
"He was a damn spy, sir. Nothing but a damn spy."
The multi-talented Andre did indeed become a spy. In 1779, he persuaded Benedict Arnold, commander of West Point, to surrender the garrison to the British. But the plot was discovered in time, and Andre was executed. Arnold escaped to England with his wife, the former Peggy Shippen, another of Andre's old flames. To this day, historians argue whether this Miskianza maiden masterminded the plot between her husband and ex-lover, which almost sabotaged American independence.
WRTI's Tom Keels in the first of a series of features exploring overlooked events in local history. A companion book, Wicked Philadelphia, will be published by the History Press in March. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony and C under their music director, Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.